Hello, this is Terrence McNally. More than 72 million Americans voted for Donald Trump. 72 million voted for his incompetence, racism, ignorance, cruelty, criminality, and for his handling of COVID-19. Here's my 2018 conversation with Milton Bennett, an expert on culting behavior. He spells out the methods Trump uses to turn his followers into a cult, impervious to contrary influence, and united in defense of their aims and their leader. Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another free forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'll be speaking today with Milton Bennett, Executive Director of the Intercultural Development Research Institute and an expert on cults and culting behavior. And we're going to talk about how that appears to be playing out with Trump and his followers. But first, I've been doing these conversations since the mid-90s when I took a hiatus in 2014. But after Trump's Electoral College victory, I felt I needed to deal with the causes, the repercussions, and the response in new interviews. And this is the 32nd such interview. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, David K. Johnston on the daily dirty work of the Trump administration. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net. Now to today's guests. A couple of weeks ago, a friend forwarded to me an article published at truthout.org. It's an article by Dar Jamail, a guest on this show several times, and it's an interview with today's guest, Milton Bennett, titled, Is There a Cult of Trump? It spells out the methods utilized, consciously or unconsciously by Trump, to turn his followers into a cult, impervious to outside or contrary influence, and united in defense of their aims and their leader. And I forward it to my wife, I'll just let you know, with the note, this is what I read just before I couldn't sleep last night. And I find Bennett's assessment convincing and frightening, pulling together strands of thought and practice that transform the Trump phenomenon into something more dangerous than a simple political divide. And the next day I reached out to Dr. Bennett, and he joins me today. Milton J. Bennett, the director of the Intercultural Development Research Institute and an adjunct professor of sociology at the University of Milano Bicocca in Italy, holds a PhD in intercultural communications and sociology and a master's in psycholinguistics. He served on the teaching faculties of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth, the Boeing Leadership Center, and the Stockholm School of Economics. Welcome, Milton Bennett, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. Let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, September 4th, 2018.
Thank you, Terrence. Happy to be here and to participate in what seems a laudable goal of creating a world that just might work.
Thank you. Thank you. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So can you tell us, I cited a few highlights and, you know, posts and so on, but can you tell us a bit about your path to the work you find yourself doing today, and feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing?
Well, originally I was interested and remain interested in consciousness, human consciousness. I think it's a fascinating subject, something that we frequently take for granted, but that we probably shouldn't. I'm influenced by a man named Julian Jaynes, who wrote a book in the late 70s on the origin of consciousness, in what he calls the breakdown of the bicameral mind. And while his overall argument is complex and I think goes beyond the focus of our conversation today, the point that I have derived from that is that consciousness is a relatively new phenomenon amongst human beings, that we human beings, while we are able to handle complex language very effectively and obviously successfully, given the numbers of the people that we have on the earth and our domination of the environment, the fact is, according to Jaynes anyway, that this consciousness that we consider authorship, the idea of being a self and an I that is capable of making decisions and being aware of that process, is an unnecessary and relatively new phenomenon. Unnecessary because we human beings are able to coordinate ourselves in pretty complex ways without that kind of consciousness. I think that that will become an extremely important point later in our conversation. And secondly, that this is a relatively new phenomenon, perhaps about 3,000 years old, according to him, and thus perhaps unstable, something that is able that we're able to move back away from rather easily. He says, and let me quote him, "The mind is still haunted with its own old unconscious ways. It broods on lost authorities, and the yearning, the deep and hollowing yearning for divine volition and service is with us still."
I'm really glad you brought that up as the context. And you're talking there about self-reflexive consciousness, not consciousness as awareness, but consciousness with a sense of self and an ability to reflect in that way, right?
Yes, thank you, Terrence, for that clarification. Indeed, although it's a mouthful, self-reflexive consciousness would be the better way to refer to this, meaning not just awareness, here I am alive, but here I am a person who is defining myself as being alive, something, the idea of authorship, as it frequently is used in other areas.
Right, an agency, right?
Agency, yes.
Yeah. So it's not just even that if I throw a rock and it hits a bird, I may eat. That can still go on. But the thing that I found curious is, having not read his book, though I've heard of it for years and years, is what happened 3,000 years ago?
Well, this is the other part of my background, which is intercultural communication. And the other intrigue that I have with his work is that he speculates that 3,000 years ago, there were a combination of a rather rapid rise in population and certain cataclysmic events that threw people together in ways that they had theretofore not been in such intense contact. And it was this combination, the combination of these factors that led to adaptive pressure, basically. He speculates that earlier people, when they met other groups, either avoided them or, if necessary, killed them. And he quotes the Bible, Old Testament, you know, where God is constantly instructing his chosen people to smite them all, kill the women, kill the children, kill everybody. And he says that was, you know, pretty much the state of our interaction with other groups. First, avoid them. Secondly, kill them. And thirdly, I suppose, convert them to be like you, and then they wouldn't be different. It was okay. But which we now call assimilation, of course. But then he suggested that at that period there was this huge cataclysmic change, and that as people tried to kill each other off in this increased level of contact, it became dysfunctional to the system, and that certain groups developed the ability to recognize themselves, as he says, hearing the voices of the gods, recognize themselves hearing this instruction to smite them all and say, well, wait a minute, maybe that's not the best thing to do, and in that way generated this self-reflective consciousness.
Now, it's interesting to me because The Evolution of God by Robert Wright, a book you're familiar with or not?
Yes.
Okay. And he says that depending on, now I think this is all probably post those 3,000 years, but I'm not certain. But he says that the voices of God seem to change depending on the political situation a people find themselves in. When the Jews were slaves, God was vengeful. When the Jews were getting along with their neighbors, God was more benevolent. How does that fit into this premise of the shift from I hear the voice of God, I act on it, to I begin to have a conversation with God, perhaps?
Well, I think the implication here is that the voices of the gods were always a kind of group consensus. They were always the voices of the community communicated to people in this auditory hallucination form. And therefore, it ought not to be surprising that when the needs of the community change, so does the content of the voices. And what James would argue is that eventually so does the mechanism change, so that no longer do we commonly hear auditory hallucinations, although some subsequent work that's being done on James's ideas suggests that people, in fact, hear voices a lot more than they acknowledge, given that it's associated with schizophrenia, but that, in fact, non-schizophrenic people rather frequently hear voices, so it's not so uncommon still for us to have these auditory hallucinations. But in any case, the mechanism largely changed into one where we were looking to others, soothsayers, priests and others, to convey the voices. So we weren't hearing them directly, but we assumed that other people, these special envoys, were hearing them, and that thus developed the edifice of modern religion.
And I think that the key notion that impacts our conversation is that the newness of the development is one thing, but it's the instability, the fragility of this consciousness, of our ability to think for ourselves and to critically think for ourselves, that is at the heart of what we're going to talk about, correct?
Yes, exactly. That given that it's unstable, given that it probably is adaptive to changing circumstances in the first place, it therefore is not surprising that under conditions of stress that we revert to this earlier condition of looking for direction from the voices of authority. And while that authority may not be attributed now to God in the sort of Greek God sense or in a monotheistic sense, it nevertheless has the same quality of an authoritarian voice that speaks to a group of people in a way that generates a kind of undeniability.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's the ease with which we move back into that condition that indeed is facilitating this movement that we'll talk about as the culting process.
And the conditions or the context that Jane cites as being welcoming to this shift 3,000 years ago, I think you make the point, and it seems to me as you described those circumstances, in some sense are what we are confronting today.
Yes, that's of course the implication there, that today, once again, we have a rapid exponential rise of population, other cataclysmic events, including rapid climate change, that are throwing people together in ways that we have not experienced at this level anyway. So huge numbers of migrants and refugees moving around, not to mention the other forms of communication and transportation that enable us to be in contact with people who are essentially operating in a different worldview, has generated a similar condition, one that challenges our adaptive strategies for dealing with otherness, essentially.
Mm-hmm. One thing that strikes me is that while they may be leaving poverty, joblessness, a dead end, it seems to me that a lot of the migration from the Middle East to Europe has been to flee authoritarianism. And then, based on what we're talking about here, they now push against the society that's been stable and fairly homogeneous. And what that does is that brings out in the people they're infringing on a return to a hunger for authoritarianism.
You point to an interesting irony.
Yeah.
I would agree. Ironic, but seemingly true, that those societies that have incorporated something like self-reflexive consciousness, and I would argue that rule-based societies are ones that are operating institutionally much like individuals with self-reflexive consciousness, meaning everybody realizes that the laws are created by people and that there is largely a choice to abide by those laws and that they could change, and they do change from time to time. So this all assumes this kind of self-reflexive consciousness. Authoritarian societies, of course, either disavow that or at least don't address those conditions at all. And ironically, as the somewhat fragile, self-reflexive society confronts these kinds of pressures, the deep and hollowing yearning for that simpler authoritarian structure kicks in. I believe that's what's happening.
Yeah, yeah. And how does the study of cults and cult behavior fit into your wider research in interculturalism?
Back in the days when I was first doing intercultural work, it struck me that the ethnocentrism, I've always been interested in ethnocentrism, and I was struck by what appeared to be the extreme ethnocentric condition of cult groups. That aside from whatever they might believe, which I never was particularly interested in, whether it was spaceship captains coming to take people away or more common deity myths or self-improvement. In all cases, I think it's relatively unimportant what the belief system of the group is. What was more important was that all of these groups seemed to share a mechanism that allowed for people in the group to see themselves as having the truth in some way, as opposed to the deluded outsiders. And it struck me that that was a sort of similar condition to extreme ethnocentrism, extreme nationalism, extreme xenophobia, where one saw one's own group as being entitled or chosen in some way, and that others were deluded, and of course, in the worst case, simply not human at all.
Mm-hmm. So before we jump into the Trump phenomenon, and we will in doing so look at some of the aspects that seem to show up in culting and cults along the way, you provided expert analysis for the media during the Rajneesh cult crisis in Oregon. And that group and that crisis is probably more well-known today than ever before due to the recent Netflix series, Wild Wild Country. And it was my experience, I watched the series, that the producers didn't really take sides. I thought it was an interesting approach, presenting the conflict between the followers of Rajneesh and the local residents of the area in Oregon that they settled. What would you add to the perspectives offered by the series? In other words, how I assume you've seen it, and how do you reflect on what happened, what people got from it, anything that people might be interested in?
Yeah. Well, I did watch the series. I thought it was very interesting. I agree with you that I think it was dealt with quite even-handedly. My initial response to the Rajneesh group when they came into Oregon, where I was living at the time, was quite positive. I thought they added an interesting element to the sometimes less variegated landscape of that state, and so I was pleased to see them. And it was only over time, as they began operating their essentially Zionist movement in the sense of reclaiming the land and doing other things that at least are mythologized as the beginning of Israel, they themselves made the connection to that. That was all very, I thought, rather laudable, although you could have course understand the perspective of people who were already living there, again, not to continue that parallel too much, but the Palestinians who might have objected to the people coming in and reclaiming land that they thought was perfectly fine, thank you, and making it their own, essentially. And so there was indeed resistance to this group. Then what began to happen was what I would describe as the culting process. So while the group itself might or might not have been referred to as a cult to begin with, I think that term is frequently used just to describe groups that you don't like, somebody who's doing something different than you're
right,
doing.
Right, doing something different, gathering together, finding some common theory, some common you know, vision and so on. Yes,
but then
there's some place.
There's
some place where
you
tips
have
over.
One group that's using techniques of coercion and suppression of consciousness, calling another group that's using similar techniques the cult and so forth. So I wouldn't say that initially that group was well defined as a cult, although there certainly were techniques that all religious groups use to generate internal support for the belief system, and certainly that group was doing that as well. What generated what I would call the culting process a little bit more definitively was in the response of the group to the resistance of the neighbors, rather than trying to form new coalitions and go through the messy representative process. They instead tried to manipulate that process in ways that I will speculate on if you want, but I may be off the point here.
Well, let me just quickly say, for people who don't know the story, is I'm going to make one point that they found that the population of the area, the city and the county that they had moved into was sparse. So originally, just their own numbers gave them control of the city through electoral process. But when they wanted to take control of the county, they actually imported thousands of folks, many homeless folks from around the country, to give them the numbers to achieve another electoral victory. And that's, it seems to me, when things began to turn.
Yes, I think there was a lot of negative response to that. It got some legal attention and so forth. And in response to that attention, the group started shifting into what I would call hardening of the boundaries.
Yep.
And that what typically happens with culting organizations is that they move from being groups of us and them. And all groups are, to some extent, groups of us and them. You know, there's a differentiation, a boundary that says inside this boundary it's us and outside it's them. That as that boundary becomes hardened, there is less and less contact between us and them. There's a restricted contact. Them become the enemies. And in the extreme condition, them, the outsiders, become dangerous dangerous enemies that need to be protected against or preemptively attacked.
Right.
And
what you're saying is when
what the direction that group went in. Yeah.
When the other becomes an existential threat to us.
Yep.
That's.
Yes. Whereas before, the other exists just as the environment in which us exists. In this extreme hardening of the boundary condition, the other becomes a threat to the existence of us, or what you might otherwise sort of loosely referred to as polarization, but this is a kind of different explanation for how that us-them distinction gets generated, maintained.
I find polarization thrown around as sort of too soft for what we're talking about, and that's where that existential threat that if you triumph, we will not exist. If you,
indeed.
You know, and that's what I think it got to.
It's more like the position frequently attributed to Trump, of there are winners and losers, but there is no win-win condition.
Right.
You never hear
right.
him talk about a win-win condition, and there are only winners and losers. So it's an extreme polarization, which I think is consistent with this hardened boundary of us and them.
Yeah. Okay, we will leave the Rajneesh folks, but I wanted to set that up just so we could sort of talk about what cults look like outside of what we're going to talk about. So why does it matter if Trump and his followers are engaging in cult behavior?
Well, if it is indeed a good explanation, that is, that they're engaging in culting processes, then it allows us, first of all, to explain what it is that we're seeing in ways other than traditional political explanations, much as, let me say, as an aside, as the FBI initially failed to distinguish between culting groups and non-culting groups. And so, for instance, in extreme situations like the Waco Branch Davidian confrontation, the FBI and other government agencies were trying to treat that group more like a group of hostages than like a culting group.
Mm.
And that led to some, I believe, extremely unfortunate circumstances. And similarly, if we try to treat this situation as a regular political situation and not as a culting situation, I think that there is a similar danger of our failing to recognize the danger points of our perhaps exacerbating the situation with certain attempts that we're making at resistance and so worsening rather than bettering the situation.
What I like about that, Milton, is that you're not saying it's, oh, the label is what's important. You're saying that, in fact, since in a society we have to deal with each other, that it might be good to recognize what you're dealing with.
Absolutely. You know, as I argued in the article I wrote for a book that was meant for the FBI after that event, called Communicating with Cults, you know, I was making the point that to communicate with a cult, we need to communicate with cults, but we need to do it differently than if we're communicating with other kinds of groups.
Yes.
And that's, I think, the situation that we're facing here, that by understanding a culting process and what Trump is doing, for instance, with these endless campaign rallies,
mm-hmm.
That people are kind of wondering, why is he campaigning, you know, and da-da-da. Well, it's because he's setting up culting processes. He's not just campaigning. He's doing something different. And if we understood that, I think that it would allow us to both become a little less exercised about some things and perhaps more sophisticated in our resistance to other things.
Yeah, and also in your sense, I think, of what things you might attempt that might have no possibility of success because you're dealing with culting behavior. And so you sort of reassess what, you know, how do you deal with this going forward? Certain things are probably going to be, you could have your expectations dashed if you think you're just dealing with extreme politics.
For instance, the clearly useless attempt to point out the inaccuracy of things that Trump says.
Yep.
You know, it has zero effect on the base, as we call that, the group of people who are true believers, essentially. And of course, that's because part of the culting process is to define from the inside certain events like fake news that in a way that will be misunderstood by outsiders. I mean, the point is to create an internal meaning that's essentially inaccessible to outsiders because it defines the insider, you know, knowing that thing. It's like the secret decoder ring.
Yep.
And as a result, the outsiders, no matter what they say, will be seen as examples of fake news or deluded or simply just a naive misunderstanding of the real truth, which exists only inside the group and is only accessible to insiders of the group. And, you know, so we should probably the implication of that would be that we would spend less time trying to point out this misinformation and these lies and other kinds of inaccuracies and do something different we can get to in a minute.
Yeah, except, however, my guess is that people who are doing that do not expect to necessarily affect those who they might not say have been culted, but they will say are the extreme. And that they want to get anybody who might be available for movement. Let me say, I read an op-ed in the Washington Post, I believe, in the last few days, in which a woman said, stop talking about Trump's base, because in doing so, you make it seem more solid, more unified, more real than it is. Any thoughts about that as an approach?
Well, yeah, this is the point that George Lakoff makes, and I like his work a lot. I think he perhaps has the most astute analysis of the left and right schism that currently exists in the U.S. And he makes the point, amongst others, that whenever we refer to something, even negatively, it affirms the existence of that thing, and so we ought to be talking about what we want to do as opposed to what they're doing that we don't like.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be that idea of don't talk about the base would be a kind of an extension of that notion. I think that to some extent we do need to analyze who are the true believers and why are they true believers.
Mm-hmm.
As part of this process, so I'm not sure how far down that
exactly.
road I'd go, but the basic idea of don't affirm, even in the negative, the thing that you want to be different, I think that Lakoff makes a good point about that.
Hello, this is Terrence McNally. 72 million Americans voted for Trump. You're listening to my 2018 conversation with Milton Bennett, who spells out the methods Trump uses to turn his followers into a cult. So again, the website to learn more about Milton Bennett's work is IDR Institute, idrinstituteoneword.org. The article that piqued my interest is There a Cult of Trump? It's Professor Bennett's interview with Dar Jamail at truthout.org. Milton Bennett is the executive director of the Intercultural Development Research Institute, an expert, as you can tell, on cult and culting behavior. And we're talking...
May I just add one thing?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
There is an upcoming article, chapter in a book. The chapter is called Group Indoctrination, Techniques of Depersonalization and Domination of Individual Consciousness, which is what we're talking about here. And that will be in a forthcoming book called Indoctrination to Hate, Pathways into Gay Bashing, Jihadism, and Groups of Hate, edited by Ed Dunbar, who has been publishing quite a number of very, very useful and interesting books on hates and hate groups and hate crimes and other things. This is coming from Prager. A number of them are out already. Look for Ed Dunbar as the editor, but this one will be out probably in another year, in half a year maybe.
You sent it to me and I've looked at it, and it really is the sort of the expansion of what one learns in that interview with Dar, or what they'll learn in listening to this one. Just very briefly, you make a distinction between the noun cult and the process of culting.
Yes, the process of culting, I think, is using three elements in a sequence that has been shown over a number of different groups, different belief systems, and so forth, to be effective in suppressing individual consciousness and hardening this boundary of us and them. The three elements are control, coercion, and conversion. Sorry for the alliteration there. Control, I'm taking to mean the attempt to control meaning, for the most part. There are two kinds of control. One of them is the control of boundaries. The other is the control of meaning. The control of boundaries is to generate, either in physical space or in social space, a distinction between us and them. Physically, of course, you separate people, isolate them in some physical way, of course, imprisonment being the extreme of that. But the social control, in this case, is to generate a boundary, which could be done either in a social group. There are a lot of social psychology studies of the social influences in such kinds of groups. Or I think increasingly we see that kind of boundary control occurring in social media, where one belongs to certain groups and not to other groups, and there are mechanisms that harden that boundary so that you're less likely to go outside of it. That's one kind of control.
Okay.
The other kind of
control
is
control
of meaning.
And you point out that defines who's the insider and who's the outsider. That's what we're starting with, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And it's the control of that process, even though that's happening all the time in any time we group ourselves. It's the control of that process and the setting up the conditions for hardening that boundary, which is characteristic of the culting process.
Very good. And then coercion.
The other kind of control is the control of meaning, as I mentioned already, where there is an intentional attempt. It's not accidental. It's an intentional attempt to generate meaning inside the group that's different than the meaning that might typically be given to that, whatever that word or idea is, outside of the group.
And let me jump in on that one just for a second so we can pop a couple of examples. Fake news is one of those, right? In other words,
yep.
what used
yep.
to be called critical press is now fake news. That is changing the meaning for the insiders Now, they're in the know, and anybody who swallows that fake news is obviously not in the know, not one of us, and somehow a little bit inferior, not clever enough to see what's going on.
Yes, I believe that's absolutely the case. The other term you hear being used a lot is collusion.
Yes.
And, again, you see lots of attempts to define that term in a way that allows the insiders to see the outsiders when they use that term as doing so in a deluded or manipulative way. As Goebbels, to bring up a terrible parallel, but unfortunately necessary,
an expert said
back in the run-up to National Socialism in Germany in the 30s, you accuse the other of doing what you're doing, but you just do it more often and more loudly, and your view prevails.
Uh-huh. So this is when people say, and they do all the time, oh, Trump's projecting. Projecting is just another side of Goebbels' advice, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he may be doing it unconsciously.
Yeah.
I have trouble attributing a whole lot of intentional manipulation in this regard to Trump, but perhaps I'm underestimating him.
By the way, Scott Adams, do you know about this Scott Adams who writes Dilbert? The popular comic strip. He's been following Trump from early on. I don't think his whole career, but early on in his since he announced a candidacy, and wrote a book in which he really praises Trump's tactics and strategies of what he calls persuasion. I interviewed him, and he believes that much of it is intentional, and so on. But just if people are interested, there is a book by Scott Adams in which he goes into it from, you know, with his point of view.
Well, and by intentional, I think that indeed he is operating intentionally to the ends that
yes.
he desires. We don't have to go into what those are, but suffice it to say, they're not altruistic and probably not supportive of the maintenance of the Constitution of the United States.
Or the well-being of others. Yes.
The well-being of the American people.
Yes, yes.
But, you know, that aside, I have observed over the years many, many leaders of these groups, both large and small, that are operating intentionally but not knowledgeably.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning if you ask them, why are you doing this, why are you doing this, the answer essentially is going to be because it works.
Yes.
And I think that if you were to ask Trump, you'd probably get a similar answer. Look at me, look at my life, look at how
yep.
things have gone for me. It works.
Yep. The deeper understanding of why it's working or what the theory might be is unimportant to him and to many others who are just doing what works.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it works, in my view, because it is re-evoking this kind of unconscious past that is in our relatively recent species history, and moving us back into that condition of absolute acquiescence to authority.
Okay, and one of the things that strikes me is that, as we said, why did... in other words, that the initial message is fear, threat, all of that, create the higher stress where the reversion then to someone to take care of me it kicks in.
Well taken, well taken. That appeal to fear has two dimensions to it, one of which the obviously generates the us-them boundary. But the other one, I think, as you say, is completely the case, that by appealing to fear, we generate stress, and that the stress in turn inclines us to look for this earlier adaptive strategy. Yeah, nice.
One of the things that people have been talking about for years is that, and this is moving away from Trump just to the far right, but the far right, the evangelical fundamentalist right and so on, the theocratic right, despite the fact that at this moment they have the White House, they have both houses of Congress, they have the Supreme Court and are likely to get more of it, et cetera, they are always the victim. That it is we're about to lose all of this. We're about to lose all the things we hold dear, whether that's abortion or guns, etc. And that fits what you're saying, is that sense of we're under attack and it's our hold is fragile leads to the dependence on the authority.
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
Coercion, so to go to the next alliterative element here, coercion is defined in traditional rhetoric as being the limitation of choice. And it's juxtaposed to information, which is the creation of additional choices, persuasion, which is attempting to influence the choice amongst viable alternatives. Could be this way, could be that way, but I'd like to argue that we should be this way. That's the kind of argument that occurs in, you know, any kind of democratic society. And coercion, which is the attempt to limit choice. And, of course, the limitation of viable alternatives ultimately is do this or I'll kill you.
Mm-hmm.
Or, as I argue in the article, Trump appears to be fairly adept at saying do this or they'll kill you.
Exactly.
Do what I say or they'll kill you.
Right.
But in any case, it's coercion, and this is well studied by Shine and Lifton and other people who did early work on brainwashing, on how this kind of coercive persuasion, as they called it, works in controlled situations. So the more boundary control you have, the more effective this coercion becomes.
What I found interesting was that contrast, that distinction with persuasion. Persuasion, you can persuade as hard as you want, but in persuasion, according to your definition, you are allowing that there are options. Coercion is there are none. And is this at play when Trump tells religious right leaders, as he did last week, that if the Democrats win the midterms, there will be violence?
Yes. Well, yes. It's a number of things. First of all, he's projecting, as we discussed earlier, something that he himself said when he was on the other side of that issue, that if I'm not elected, there will be violence. but in addition to that, he's jacking up the idea that there is no choice. Just as an aside, we should be careful not to ever use the term "we have no choice." Is it you know, sort of in Lakoff terms? It essentializes this idea of no choice and moves us subtly, I think, in the direction of failure to exercise consciousness. But in any case, the coercive process is one that is being used to generate that condition intentionally.
Right, and let me just...
knowledgeably, but intentionally.
Yeah, and let me just jump in and say, for anyone who wants references, of course, he comes down the escalator announcing his campaign, and immigrants are rapists and criminals. That's the fear to create the need for the authoritarian leader. The prospect of random violence, the prospect is constantly there. The inauguration speech, when our cities are sites of carnage, this is an imaginary world, but one that creates the conditions for the response we're talking about.
Exactly. And that moves to the third position,
yep.
The third element, which I call conversion. And it's been my observation in these culting groups of any kind, again, new religions or political groups or self-help groups, that the most effective of the groups has a core group of true believers, using Eric Hoffer's term from the back in the 50s, I guess, 60s,
yeah.
Maybe, that he wrote that book, True Believer, that's become a meme in the society. But in fact, it was a very thoughtful treatment. The Eric Hoffer, the longshoreman philosopher, they called him back in those days. Yeah, he's a Bay Area guy.
Yep.
Anyway, there needs to be this core group of true believers who will exercise the social control, who will be consumers of whatever the redefinition of truth is that's occurring inside the group, and as such generate the critical mass of the group. So these people need to be converted, and they need to be constantly converted, and thus those rallies. The rallies are conversion efforts. their efforts of generating the kind of essentially brainwashing activity. And brainwashing is simply overstimulation or understimulation associated with certain kinds of suggestion. So in the case of rallies, there's a lot of overstimulation. Then there are a lot of suggestions that are being made in the form of cries, you know, lock her up, things like that, build the wall, that these become almost hypnotic suggestions that are planted during this time of high activation, intentionally, again, in such a way as to generate a group of true believers that will, as you said earlier, be existentially threatened by people who disagree with their view.
Now, you, one thing I will say is that it makes, when I read this part and realized what was going on at these rallies, it even a more definitive sense than I had in the past, that the fact that CNN played Trump rallies for free in entirety from the beginning of his campaign for several months gave people a chance to sit at home on their couch and soak up this conversion experience. But you talk about the fact that it isn't just that you change sides or you adopt a new belief. It's more that it happens instantaneously. It's that St. Paul getting struck off the horse, right, and going from attacking the Christians to leading. How can that account for as many people as seem to have been converted, given that there were only so many around? In other words, I can see when people put themselves into specific situations and get through that, as you say, overstimulated, understimulated, create a condition that makes snapping conversion possible. It seems to me, though, that I don't see how there have been enough opportunities to create the populace that there is. What's your thought about that?
Well,
in other words, you're saying that it is partially one of the pieces of this is that it is a physiological response. It's going on with, you know, a flood of emotion and neurotransmitters and so on at this moment where you go, my God, why didn't I see that? You know, my God, now I know why this is happening and so on. Is that happening enough that there could be that? I mean, in other words, not everybody's been to a rally. How are they having these?
Not everybody, but you may recall that earlier I used the term critical mass.
Yes.
And I think that's probably the mechanism that's operating here, that there is indeed a critical mass necessary of people who have been through that experience. You know, the snapping experience, as I describe it, I'm using a term from Conway and Siegelman from back in the 70s. They, you know, I kind of like it. You know, indicates exactly this notion that it's something that happens to you fast.
Yes.
You know, you were on your horse and you fall off the horse and the scales have fallen from your eyes.
Right.
And the important thing about the quickness of this process is that it generates a physiological condition, lots of hormonal changes, neural changes, and so forth, and that physiological condition we recognize in ourselves. We frequently attribute it to the truthfulness, to the authenticity of something. So when we feel that way, and you've got somebody standing in front of you saying, and he is saying, the reason you feel that way is because of the truth of what I'm saying,
yes,
or because of the wonderfulness of me, or whatever he's saying.
In other
saying.
Words, they're having an aha moment. We've all had aha moments. That's what they're having on steroids, right?
They're having aha moments, and they're in the presence of a person who is claiming responsibility for that.
Right.
That's important. And the more people that he has had that direct contact with, which is why I think he's out there having that, the more he generates that critical mass. And then there's a bunch of other people who are getting that via CNN or Fox News or, you know, word of mouth, who are on the periphery, who maybe see themselves as being sort of insiders, but they're not the core group of true believers in the same way.
That's right. What you're saying is once you have a critical mass of people who've had the snap experience, who've had the conversion experience, people get attracted to being part of a club that feels that way about themselves.
I believe so.
Okay. We've got about 6 minutes. I mean, it's been fascinating and it's moved very quickly. Where are we now and how do we handle this? What from this analysis, what's your advice?
Well, let me just briefly say that these elements go through a relatively predictable set of steps.
Yes.
To get them established. And I think that will bring us to the answer to your question.
Yeah.
The first of those steps is the seduction, which is the appeal to needs which are created, such as the need for security from supposed threats from the outside, which we've talked about already. Seduction then leads to disorientation, and we've been discussing techniques of disorientation, which are not only the direct rallies, but I think if you do watch Fox News, which I do occasionally as well, it's a very, very intentionally disorienting framework, I think. Lots of emotional activation and fast shifts from one thing to the other and other things that would be seen by the experts in brainwashing as being techniques that are also used by people who are brainwashing, not to make the obvious connection.
Right.
Then snapping, as we just discussed, and then finally, there's something called group maintenance, and I define group maintenance as the fourth stage of the culting process, and an important one, where the movement from us and them needs to become the movement of us better, them worse, which then typically moves to the position of us victims, them enemies. As you pointed out earlier, commonly associated with with both religious and other kinds of groups. And finally, then, the paranoid position, which is they're the enemies, we must strike them preemptively.
Mm.
And this is what happened to the Rajneeshis in going back to the Wild Country. Where they, by poisoning the salad bar, were making a preemptive strike, essentially, against people that they thought would be against them in this takeover of the county. And that's when the group basically went over the line into such a severe culting condition that it was appropriate that they were taken apart.
Mm-hmm.
What typically happens to groups who are at that stage of paranoia is that they either fall apart internally, that is, that they lose their center, they bifurcate, means that they split into camps, and I think that in the current condition we could hope for that, because the alternative to that when groups become paranoid is that they do indeed engage in a preemptive strike.
Right, and the fellow that was arrested recently for threatening folks at the Boston Globe because they were the enemy of the people. That's where we begin to see the preemptive violence.
Yeah, and so when Trump says that there will be violence, I don't think he's referring to that violence occurring from the victorious Democrats.
Were
that hopefully to be the case. But rather what he is signaling to his base, again, to refer to this group of true believers, that he's basically making it okay for them, as he has in the past, to consider violence as one response to what they have defined as an existential threat.
So one thing I want to jump in, I do want you to, what do we do in this? But one of the thing that you say, and this may be the last one you get to answer, actually, I'm sorry, but is that in opposing this sort of thing, you may have to be authoritarian to win these people away, and that Democrats and progressives might not be authoritarian enough for their taste?
Well, I mean, certainly that would be one way to look at this, is that you set up a counter-culting process. And, yeah, this was actually tried back in the days of they called it deprogramming,
right? You know,
where they'd pull Ted Patrick and other people, they'd pull people out of groups and essentially put them into a similar condition,
right,
but with different suggestions,
yeah,
you know, and try to deprogram them. In the end, it really wasn't very effective.
Right. I don't think that's what's going to happen. So what should we be doing?
Well, first of all, I think that we should understand this process as one of true believerism, not as one of a considered political opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, we ought not to be treating, as Paul Krugman argues, we ought not to be treating these as equivalent opinions, as equivalent conditions, that we are not dealing with political view A and political view B. We are dealing with a culting organization that has a true believer position which cannot and will not consider alternatives. And as such, conversation about alternatives is unlikely to be effective. I would say at this point that the only thing we can do is vote. I think we need to be extremely attentive to, again, the National Socialism development in Germany in the 30s, where one of the first actions of the incoming fascist government was to dismantle the voting process, was to move into making sure that there was no mechanism for voting them out. And I'm sorry to say that it would not surprise me, and I see evidence of this already, of that happening with the current administration. As such, this upcoming election, I'm sorry to say, may be the last chance that we have.
And I know we hate saying those sorts of things, that there is no choice, or, you know what I mean, back ourselves in the corner. But as you're saying, the gerrymandering, the voter suppression practiced by the GOP has been a political survival technique, not necessarily associated with culting, but it has consciously prepared the way for weakening and the possibility of dismantling electoral democracy that fits cultism and fascism like a glove.
I'm sorry to say that's the case. So my recommendation would be vote. I've been saying to everybody before it's too late, exercise this right, whatever trouble it takes. I think that were this not to be successful, or even if it is successful, that we then need to be continuing our interaction with the other group, not in terms of a debate,
right,
but in terms of a relationship.
Mm.
So when I hear people say, look, we're all Americans, we're all trying to make this country go, we're all human beings, we're all dedicated to the well-being of each other, that these kinds of appeals to universalism, to our common humanity, I think are more likely to create the conditions for people to move out of that culting condition. And that's what we're trying to do in the long run, because we will eventually move in back into a condition where we're living together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And for us now, I think we would be well advised to try to create the conditions of living together rather than the conditions of greater polarization.
Of winner take all in this kind of situation. So again, the website where you can learn more about Milton Bennett's work is IDR Institute, one word, idrinstitute.org. The article that we've been talking about is There a Cult of Trump? Professor Bennett's interview with Dar Jamal at truthout.org. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, and transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or a world that just might work.com. They're the same website. Terrence McNally is TerrenceMcNally. If you want to receive a weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 7 or 8 relevant and timely articles, sign up at my site or email me at TEMcNally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at iTunes. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, etc. Thanks to G, my engineer, Mark Maxwell, and Greg Baca in production, and George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Milton Bennett. Keep up the good work.
Pleasure talking with you.
Hey kids, do you listen to us on ProgressiveVoices.com? Well, as the Progressive Voices audience has grown, so have our bandwidth costs. I mean, we've tried to protect the limited commercial nature of the stream, so to keep up with costs, we need your help. Talking to you, you might say we're victims of our own success. With nearly a million regular listeners, the cost of operating the stream has grown beyond our wildest expectations. If you want to continue enjoying my show and others on the free mobile Progressive Voices platform, pitch in now. Won't you go to progressivevoices.com /donate and hit that donate button. Progressivevoices.com. Do it now.
If you want to continue enjoying great shows like Randy Rhoads, Stephanie Miller, Tom Hartman, Leslie Marshall, and so many others on the free mobile Progressive Voices platform, please go to progressivevoices.com and press the donate button right now. Thank you.